Good morning. How is everybody? It's lovely to be here, and you're listening to Rolly's Rebel Republic, also known as the Banana Republic. And I shall try my very best to entertain you with some decent tunes and some interviews and some stories. So, without further ado, let me just paint the picture. Let me, but first, yep, it's working. Let me paint the picture and welcome. I would like at least say thank you to Tin. You did a great set. That's the word I'm looking for. I was upstairs. Morning, X2180. And good morning, Tin. Good morning, Adam D. Good morning, M. Chamley. Good morning, Utsaho. And Claudio M, yeah, that story on Mastodon about the stolen phone is a bit scary. And for those who are listening in the future, the Anon Radio has a Mastodon account, mastodon.sdf.org, and a lot of the people who are inside COM are there. So if you're looking for a friendly home, and you're looking for a place to escape Twitter or Facebook, head over to Mastodon. But right now, I am going to say that this is a bit of a there's a tendency towards rebellion in this show, and a lot of my friends say Rolly the Rebel. I don't know why. It's just because maybe I choose different ways of doing things, but we get there in the end, and so I shall play you some Dusty Springfield, and after that I'll come back and play you some interesting interviews, at least from my perspective. And we're focusing on money today. Actually, why don't I just do it differently? Why don't I just go straight into the first interview? This is Douglas Rushkoff from 2009.
This has been an exciting week. We started out with economic doom, and according to Bloomberg Radio, which I listened to a bit on the way over here when I couldn't get FMU in the tunnel, the financial crisis is over. Did you know? Tim Geithner came up with a banking plan, and where what's going to happen is basically the government is going to guarantee that all these bad assets aren't really so bad, while they let hedge funds invest in the bad assets. So the hedge funds get the benefit if the bad assets turn out to be good ones, and you and I, or rather you and my grandchildren, get to pay for the bad assets if they turn out to be bad. So that's actually a typical deal. That's kind of the way things have been working for the last couple of hundred years. It's just a touch more transparent now for those of us who feel like looking at it. I've been writing pieces.
Yep, it's a touch more transparent now. And thank you, Tin, for reminding me that there's a slight echo. That's my monitor, which is my iPhone. And behind me, my daughter reminds me that that's our budgie that landed on our roof. And it looked very hungry, so I put up a bowl of seed, and it jumped into the bowl of seed, and I brought it into the home, and he's been a member of the household ever since. So now let us play the Dusty Springfield. This song is called The Middle of Nowhere. I really don't think I'm going to get through all my songs, but I've got quite a few. So I'm going to play a bit of this, and we'll go from there.
You
I'm in the middle of nowhere. Come and show me the way. What a perfect line. And I'll let this play, and we'll have the budgerigar behind here accompanying some of the stories. And where are we? We're on Saturday the 30th because I'm in Australia, and you guys are in the past at Friday the 29th of July 2022. This week's been quite interesting because I've been trying to go to a few more gigs, and I went to the Majestic Theatre up in Pomona, the longest running silent theatre in the world. With big red drapes and wooden floors and a big pipe organ and a piano and a screen and a stage. And we listened to the Kleptomaniacs. Now that's just by and by. That's a friend of mine who played there with his band, and it was very nice. And I just thought, wow, Stoke Sauce should do something there. Hang on. We don't want the song to play yet. Okay, so I should be careful to get on to the next interview. This is Douglas Rushkoff again, and this time he is chatting about the financial market, and this is quite a long interview, so not interview, but excerpt. Let's go for it, but by the end of the show, you'll be pretty angry, I imagine.
First and foremost, I'm a media theorist. That's what I've studied. It's what I'm supposed to get my PhD in if I ever have time to write a dissertation. It's what I teach. I understand media. And what I decided to do about 10 years ago was to start looking at money as a medium, because it is a medium. It's either printed into existence, it's digital, it's a mode of exchange, it's a medium between people. And then applying the tools of a media theorist to money in order to understand what are the biases of this medium. That's what media theorists like to do. We look at TV, we look at telephones, we look at the internet, we look at print, and we say, what are the biases of this medium compared to another one? So one of the great early media theorists, Walter Ong, he was really obsessed with what happened when we moved from an oral culture to a literate culture, from speaking to writing. Well, speaking has certain biases. You've got to be in the same place. It makes it harder to lie. It means that you're breathing together with someone when you're talking. It means your communication happens at the same time. As compared to written text, well, it can happen over a longer period of time. You don't really have to be there. Sometimes it's easier to lie. But on the other hand, you're more responsible for the things you've said because now it's in paper. And he looked at, well, how do things change when you use one medium versus another? McLuhan looked at what happens as we move from print media to electronic media. What does that do to our consciousness? How do we see things differently? And what I've been looking at lately is, well, what are the underlying biases of money and of the money that we use? You know, and the money that we use is just one kind of money. There were once many different kinds of money. Some monies were earned into existence, right? You'd go to the, you'd come back from the fields with your grain, with your corn, with your stuff, and you'd bring it to a grain store and get a receipt. That's the way money worked. For hundreds of years, that's what people understood money as, a receipt for the work they had done, a receipt for the grain they had produced. And they would trade it with other people who lived close enough to that grain store for that grain receipt to have some value. Now, as people wanted to do long distance trade, they came up with other kinds of monies that worked for long distances, like gold. Now, gold was great because everybody valued it wherever you were. But not just regular gold. What happened around the Renaissance is kings were saying, look, people can't just deal in gold. They better deal in my gold. Otherwise, I'm going to keep getting poorer as the economy grows, as people get rich, as merchants get wealthy. So coin of the realm wasn't just gold. Coin of the realm was gold that was stamped by the king to be gold, to be legal. And any other money at that point, and this is people were like, how could this be true? You want to see a book that explains a lot of this? Read The Wheels of Commerce, Civilization and Capitalism from the 15th to the 18th Century, Volume 2 by Fernand Braudel. It's a great one. Or better yet, look at the books of this guy, Bernard A. Lettier. I'm not really saying it right. L-I-E-T-A-E-R. Jeanine, do you know how to pronounce French? Can you say that?
Latier.
I'm sorry. He wrote a book called On Human Wealth, which is great. You just do a web search for him, or come to mediasquatters.net, or rather mediasquat.net, and I'll have a link to that. These are great books on how this work, how this money came to be. But Philip the Fair is a great example of someone who decided to outlaw all of these other currencies. Originally, they used religion as the reason. Well, people are using Moorish money, Arab money, and there's, you know, Arab gods on here. This is the wrong deities for our people to look at. So they sort of based it on religion. But they decided that people had to use Philip's coin. And the reason Philip wanted people to use his coin was so that everything had to be run through him and his central bank. He was the treasury. And then when he needed money for a war, when he needed money for a new castle, he could debase the currency, pull some gold out of it, and reissue it at a lower value, and he would get more money and more money that way. Whatever he couldn't tax, he would just take right out of the coin. Now, money doesn't work exactly like that today. Actually, it works worse. The fact is, now money, at least in the U.S. and in most other developed nations, money is borrowed from a bank. So we borrow money. Even our government doesn't print money. Our government is no longer, even though the Constitution says something about this, the government does not issue money anymore. The Fed issues money. A bank, the Federal Reserve Bank, issues money. When our government wants money, we borrow it from the Fed. You see, in the old days, it is true that even a centralized currency wasn't entirely borrowed into existence. If you went and fought in a war, you know, the king would give you some gold. I mean, that was worth a few pieces of royal money. If you built something for the king, you would get money. So at least a little bit of money, whatever the government spent, was at least being put out for work. Now, if you work for the government, the money you get, it's not like the government prints it for you. The government borrows it from the Fed for you, or the government collects it in taxes from people who've borrowed it somewhere up the line. So technically, meaning in reality, the money that we have always works by paying it up the pyramid to whatever bank was last
lent it out. And what really happens is money has the greatest value for the first person who gets it, and the first person to make it has the most control, or all the control in some cases, which is why I'm very, you know, I've got the hairy eyeball when it comes to MFTs and certainly those tokens that you get at the shopping center, the Woolies things where they say rewards cards, because those are pretty worthless. They can change the value of that any moment they like, and it's just designed to incur loyalty. But let us go into this. Let's just say we're no longer going to live like that, and this next song is I discovered very recently, and I quite like it. It's got a sort of well, here it goes. Let's just play it. It's interesting.
I look for trouble and I found it, son. Straight down the barrel of a lawman's gun. I try to run, but I don't think. Ain't living long like this.
different angel. She's a roadhouse queen. Make Texas Ruby look like Sandra Dee. I want to love her, but I don't know how. I'm at the bottom of the jailhouse now. Ain't it been long?
Sure is an interesting song, I Ain't Living Long Like This by Waylon Jennings, and I think it comes from the Grand Theft Auto game or the film, I'm not sure, but yeah, we've got to do something, and it really comes up to us to do it, it's up to us to do it, and by doing it, I mean just living our lives peacefully, like for example, it's 33 days to spring, and, hey bird, come on, take that noise. I think I should move you somewhere. Hey, quiet now. And 33 days to spring, which means it's 33 days to your autumn, and a bit of relief from my, from what I believe you guys are going through, quite a lot of hot weather, very, very hot weather, I believe, over there where you guys are. And what we ought to do now is just make things better for ourselves. That means fixing things up. And by rebellion, or being a rebel, I mean not following the consumer standards, because they really are just trying to tell us what to do. All the social media sites, for example. And the very fact that they can throw you off if they don't like what you say, which I know happens on SDF too, but I think it only happens here if you're hurtful or nasty. I think you can say what you like other than that. But, so in a way, they control the currency, don't they? Because they can control what they promote and what they tell us and what they show us and what we see more of. And we don't really know. We're behind this black screen. So it comes down to talking to real people. People like Tin. People like Adam D. People like Optrix and X2180 and M. Chamley. And Claudio M. And what's his name? Stephen. And Tobe. What's his name? Sorry, Steve. And what am I doing? So yeah, this next interview is shamelessly stolen from some podcasts, from a podcast called The Media Squat. It was one of Douglas Rushkoff's first podcast, which I managed to track down on WFMU, and I've been listening, working my way through them quietly, and just taking things that I find quite interesting. Being a rebel by not being conformist. Yes, that's exactly what I mean. Thank you, X2180. That's exactly what I mean. So I've been fixing my own cars, making my own things, trying to mow my own lawn. However, at the moment, I've got a guy coming in because I've got 2 acres of long grass that needs cutting, and he's coming in today, and we'll be cutting from the top to the bottom by the creek. And what we have to do is stand up on our own 2 feet and do things for ourselves. I'm going to tell you a story about what happened at KFC after this next interview, but let's enjoy this one.
Play clip one. This is Richard Metzger introducing something called DisinfoCon in 1999, which I was at and Grant Morrison was at.
The 20th century has just been bookended. The revolutionary meme spread in the last century by Crowley, Allen Ginsberg, William Burroughs, Leary, Abby Hoffman, and some of our speakers here today have been internalized by a large segment of the population. And in the new millennium, these thought forms will become fully externalized in the culture. When disinformation launched at the end of 1996, fewer than 20 corporations controlled over 90% of the major media outlets. At that time, I described the need for an antidote to the corporate control of the major media outlets. But with the advent of the internet, the incredible number of new magazines on the stands, and new cable television networks starting up every month, this is no longer really the case. Just 3 years later, there are a lot of new companies jumping into the entertainment and infotainment arenas. New voices and different opinions are being heard. In the new media climate, diversity is inevitable, and the lock these 20 corporations previously had on consensus reality is a thing of the past. Those companies are still around, but they've been forced to share their media monopoly with a lot of competition. Whoever controls what you see controls what you think, but our reality is no longer based on what they tell us. With the new media tools we all have at our disposal, all of us, with the inclination to make our voices and opinions heard loudly, can now more fully participate in the debate. Think about it. There is more free speech today than there has ever been at any point before in history. Very simply, the need to fill hundreds of television channels and radio stations and movie theaters and newspapers and magazines with content caused consensus reality, fed to excess, to burst like a piñata. But the modern revolutionary doesn't necessarily want to bring the system down or destroy capitalism. Far from it. In a society where capital is king and when every with a .com is making bank like they are printing cash in the cellar, and many of them are, the point should be to get as close to that AOL, Time Warner, AT&T, CNN, CBS, ABC, NBC, RCA money as you possibly can get. If they will give, you should grab and not think twice. The truly up-to-date rebel rouser wisely seeks the path of least resistance and subverts from within. The multinational media corporations need people like us to make their software, write their articles, and produce their television shows. Smell an opportunity for mischief? I do. Today's aspiring modern now-a-go-go rebel should take a page from the book of Simpsons creator Matt Groening, or Trey Parker and Matt Stone, the guys behind South Park, or Marilyn Manson. The most subversive thing anyone can do is become popular. There is no point in having a feeble voice if you don't have to. If a tree falls in the forest and no one sends out a press release to the media, it didn't happen. Obscurity isn't admirable. It isn't anything but obscure. If your message is packaged in a sexy, funny, and interesting way, people will listen. The days of throwing Molotov cocktails and getting beaten up by cops, although Seattle did look like fun, is out. The days of living in a penthouse apartment, driving a Lexus, and beating your enemies at their own game is in. Have your cake and throw it too, in other words.
Hey, Richard.
Hey.
Memories of 1999?
Yeah, exactly.
What do you
I don't know how much of it you played, by the way. I couldn't hear
we
it.
We played the whole thing because we were trying to get you the whole time. So we played your whole introduction speech to the DisinfoCon 1999.
Right.
Just to let everyone know, you're all in the Media Squad, our last best hope for airtime on WFMU Radio, WFMU.org. You'll be able to call in on this segment and certainly the next one with questions and comments for Richard Metzger or me at 201-209-9368. 201-209-WFMU, or pose questions to David, our community director, in the chat room right now at WFMU.org. So, Richard, do you not to say you have to maintained the same opinion over time, but how are things changed from how you thought they were changing then? Or is everything full speed ahead?
Well, I mean, that speech was, you know, as you said, 10 years ago, and it was delivered to an audience of media professionals primarily in New York City. So I was talking at that time about monkey wrenching the system.
Mm-hmm.
You gave a speech right after mine, keynoting that event, where you discussed how the counterculture had won.
Right. That was, I thought that if we as a counterculture basically dropped the duality at that point, stopped being against culture and declare victory, what would happen then? We just walked around like we'd won, and they're all just desperate for us now. Well, we saw how well that worked. I mean, to some extent, maybe we did, you know, and the collapse of the economy as we know it is the necessary result of that.
Well, maybe. I mean, if you look at it, the aims of the counterculture, the classic counterculture of the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, you know, and on and through punk rock culture and up through cyber culture, you know, things like Mondo 2000 and Magazine. But the, you know, the goals were at that time being able to travel freely in different cultures, gay rights, marijuana and other drugs being legal. You know, and those are things which have by and large come to pass or are coming to pass. So, in that respect, yeah, you could look at it and say the counterculture won. But there's another aspect of that too, which is in that speech I was talking about. It's simply that people like us at our age, people who are younger than us, you know, that we're old enough that we can get jobs in these media places. And like I say, it was a good place to, you know, look to monkey wrench the system. At this point, there's a different current obviously going on in our culture because of the collapse of the finance. Those counterculture voices were, I don't know what happened between when you lost me and when we got back on, because we were talking about fanzines and boing boing, not fanzines, but rather underground magazines.
Right. The caller was asking, right. And there was a caller who was asking a question just about what you were talking about. So we tried to bring him in, and he, Joe, from Pennsylvania. And he was asking about, you know, where's the counterculture today? What's your opinion of its health? And I guess what you're answering is that you don't see it as a counterculture anymore. You see it as a kind
Absolutely.
Of a different thread.
Yeah, anything that's kind of self-consciously, you know, counterculture, it just seems juvenile at this point and sort of behind the times. You know what I mean? It's like a relic of, you know, of a different era, if you ask me. But like I say, the interesting thing for me is to see how, you know, friends of ours like Mark Frauenfelder and David Peskovitz and Shani Jardin, Cory Doctorow, you know, people who, you know, are like us, sort of bohemian weirdos, and they have a media platform which is as big as, you know, let's say Time Magazine.
Right.
You get right down to
well, certainly
it, you know?
Its online presence is perhaps bigger.
Yeah, maybe by a factor of several times over. So, you know, that's a, you know, obviously that's a fascinating thing to be able to point to.
Right. And these are just regular people. In other words, this isn't part of some, you know, time at this point. I mean, is a lineage. I mean, down from what's his name who used to run that? Henry, he was a famous capitalist. Mussolini was one of his heroes. He put him on the cover a few times. I mean, it was an outgrowth of the true old boys network, Henry Luce. And Boing Boing was the product of the Baby Boys Network. I mean, really, this was part of our gaggle, our extended gaggle, mm-hmm. which is what makes it both so fun and so
product.
And so.
All right, so there you have it.
Successful. I mean, the
right.
question
these are just
though, is,
people like us, and yeah, this certainly is a society where we are right now in. Come and inside of SDF, this is kind of like where things happen. So it's interesting. And I think what's also interesting is that you have to find the people who are like you. For example, now this is a funny story, and I told it to someone because that's important. I had a really nice time yesterday. I went out to the seaside, and I stopped off for a KFC, a Zinger burger, one of my favorites. And I went into the store, the KFC store, and stood around. And There were some people there who had been waiting for a while, it seemed, and they were a little bit edgy, you know, they seemed impatient, and I was chilled watching them because I wasn't in a hurry, and I didn't really mind how long it took, but it was interesting to see how they presented their anger. They weren't able to articulate why they were annoyed, and so when they dished out the vendor just, you know, it was like water off a duck's back. And I'm not saying that's a good way to run business for KFC, but I'm just saying it didn't make any change. And there were these other people there, and they looked like people from, you know, that movie where, oh, I wish I could remember the name of it, like it's like Redemption or something, not Shawshank, but about the city folk who get stuck up in the hills with these hillbillies, and they go whitewater rafting, and the story goes a bit awry. Well, they looked like those sort of people. So I came outside and I was sitting there eating my Zinger burger, daydreaming and watching the crowd go by. And what happened was they came out and they were sitting at the table and they were very restless, and they got up and grabbed all their things and went onto the roadside and tried to wave a taxi and yelled at a taxi. And you can't help but look across at them. And they kind of like looked at me and stared at me, one of them, and what are you staring at, Mr. Monopoly Man? Which was funny for me, because I don't know what I can only imagine they were referring to my moustache, but I continued to look at them and just give a very ambient, you know, appearance. I didn't want to go causing trouble with these guys, but they were losers in the biggest sense. And they got into the taxi and they were still yelling as they got into the taxi, and I just watched them go off and I thought about it and I finished my zinger. And that's part A of the story, and then part B of the story is this section. So I finished my zinger and I walked around to where I had parked my car, and I drove through the, I walked across the drive-through, and there were two young men in a car, and they looked up at me and they gave me the biggest smile ever, which is what I'm used to, not the old comments from the hillbillies. And they gave me the biggest smile ever and said, well, they didn't say anything, but so I gave them the thumbs up and they gave it back, and I kind of like walked away from that thinking about part B, and that is what life is about. You only have the kinds of people that you are liked by, and you can do nothing about the others. And people like you, it's almost like a spiritual thing. It's like they're from another netherland, or the other people are birds of a feather. So, yeah, I don't know what you guys think of that story, but that happened to me, and it reminded me that not everyone is the same, and they're not coming from the same position or perspective. So just let those people be and move on. And I do get their point, I suppose, about Monopoly Man, but they were up to no good, and the fact that I was just, they were in front of me, I'm not going to look at the ceiling. But here is a poster, I suppose, on Mastodon, which I'm putting up now on the link, which maybe is what they were referring to, Mr. Monopoly Man. Now, I don't normally wear that funny hat. I don't ever wear that funny hat, actually. But I did that day because I was at a school picnic, and the young lady who I was walking through the woods with was wearing that, and I stuck it on just for fun and took the photo, or she took the photo. Yeah, So this next song is David Bowie, and we all know it, and it's a great song. Okay, this is actually Billy Idol. My apologies. I pressed play, but instead of stopping it, I'm going to let it play halfway through. And we're at 37 minutes, so I've got a lot to go through, and I'm going to fade it out and play an interview or the real Bowie. That is such a nice song and takes me back 20 years, which reminds me that some of the interviews that we're listening to are from 2009, and in those interviews they're listening to excerpts from 2001. So the positive view they place on things like, you know, winning the war, or at least, you know, winning the battle for the media war is quite dated by 20 years. So. Not quite true, because now we aren't fighting flesh and blood, we're fighting algorithms and programming and censorship. So this is why I'm rallying a call to rebel and to push back against these things, and certainly to gather in small communities like this one, and to be encouraging and hopeful. So one of the reasons I stopped at that KFC, by the way, was because I was going to go to the art shop to get some, just to say thank you, because they're always helping Stokes with his things, and they're always printing his stuff, and they quite like his art. So I walked in there, and they said, man, the newest art I gave them was fantastic, they just loved it. And it's a very simple business card with two sides, hand-drawn by someone that I discovered on the beach. And that's a story in itself. I might just tell you that story, because I'm walking down Queen Cartwright and I stopped these beautiful homes, and they're very expensive, I'd say, but close to the ocean. And these particular ones were not, they were older style, but they hadn't been developed, and they were still renters. And there was this surfboard on the letterbox, which I looked at and thought, man, that's a really nice bit of drawing. And I saw some lady driving, young lady, and she looked across at me, and I thought she might be like wondering why I'm looking at her property, but just a letterbox. And she said, That's my housemate. Do you want to contact me? I said, yeah, of course. Love that. So she gave me the card and I contacted him and his artwork came out. So I went to go thank these guys and they were very friendly. And so where is this going? It's going to this place. If you want me to send you some of Stoke Source's art, I shall post it to your address, then feel free because to let me know and relay your PO box or address and I shall put some of Stoke Source's stickers into a and some of his artwork or prints of his artwork into an envelope and ship it to wherever you are. So that is something I thought I would just mention. The other thing I'd like to mention is the fact that the song playing now is Beaten Generation by Zada. Zada was a band that used to play in clubs when I was a kid, say 18, 19 years old. And it's quite a nice ahead of its time, really. I shall just drop the volume here on me speaking for 10 or 20 seconds and then come back to chat. A prejudice and misinformation, the beaten generation, the beaten generation. Open your Beaten Generation by Dada, and the album's called Mind Bomb. And we don't want to be that beaten generation. We certainly don't want our children and grandchildren to be included in that. So we got to stand up and do some stuff. And on the line of doing stuff, let me just check my show notes here because I might have one or two more things to say. Talk to people everywhere. So when you see people, don't be afraid of sharing your views. You've got to work out whether they are going to be in your lives for longer or not. And whichever way it is, you've got to just chat about things. But and I find being friendly is a very big plus, to the point where it's quite strange because I go to the beach and my lovely wife doesn't enjoy the beach as much as I do. And I also get up quite early and head out that way. But I get people just smiling a lot. And I don't know if it's because I've got grey hair or for what it is, or if they just see. I remember this guy coming up to me and he said, you know, one day when I'm older, I want to be like you. Because I was jumping into a pool. And I kind of like looked around me to see who he was talking to because I still don't feel at all old. And so the point was my kids were in the pool and I decided to join them. So I ran to the pool and did a mighty jump and landed into this pool and splashed everyone and hung out. So. And another example, we went to the coffee club and down at Coolum, and it was quite cool, and the ocean was blowing and frothy. And I walked past this pizza shop, trying to find the rest of my family, because we'd split up temporarily to go get food or whatever. And we were rejoining. And this girl comes out, young surfer girl comes out, and she just looks at me and gives me the biggest smile ever. So I guess that's like finding the others, the people who are like you and who realize that, and just to reiterate, I don't normally wear that crazy hat. I just got bushy, fluffy hair that looks like I've been surfing for the last 10 years, which is longer than most people wear theirs. Where am I going? I've lost track. I actually need to get onto this next section, which is W, and I'm going to press W, and we're at 48, so we've got 12 minutes.
Get it this way. I don't think that the Obama administration, and I voted for him, and I admire the man, and I think he's a great president already, and he's only been in office for 40 days, but there's one problem that I think that he and his economic advisors have, and it's this blind spot that the economy is essentially dead. If you can diagnose the corpse, there's not much. What are you going to do for this patient? I want to know what they are going to do when they become convinced that, okay, well, maybe all of these things that we try to do to resuscitate this corpse, all of this money that we've, you know, sent down this black hole, what are they going to do then for these people who are two paychecks away from complete financial oblivion?
Yeah, and that's, I mean, and I voted do. And I voted for him because he's a community organizer. And community organizing is exactly the cure for the problem that we have.
Oh, I would agree with you there, too. I mean, I think he's, you know, if you read his book, or especially if you listen to his book on tape, the President of the United States is a person of depth and character, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I think he's going to understand this. But right now, these guys, they think that they can resuscitate this corpse, like I was saying. Beyond that, like I say, what are they going to have to do for these people who are out of work, who have no money, no savings, and they're, you know, are facing being put out on the street? I think the answer is socialism. There's really no other answer to it. They're going to and they're going to have to print money the way that they've been printing money and making money up for the banks, because they're just pulling things. You know, they're not printing money; they're just adding a zero somewhere along the line in their digital currency. But they're going to have to expand Section 8 to keep people in their apartments who are renters. They're going to have to probably have some kind of moratorium. Imagine if there will be, and I think this is easy to envision, a 30% of the workforce is put out of work. That's easy to envision that happening. It's happened.
Right. At the same time that a bunch of Iraq war veterans come back, and a lot of those people out of work are going to be cops who are taken off the street. I mean, you've got a giant population of angry men over 30 who know how to use weapons. It's not pretty.
but also think about this, too. I mean, what about people who are, you know, the parents of sick children who are now losing their health benefits?
Right.
Right? I mean, and what are they going to do? Or people who are diabetics who need, you know, constant, you know, medical attention, that kind of thing. This is, it's, I mean, there's a, what's there's a, Denzel Washington film called John Q.
I know. I always talk to my wife about that whenever we're deciding on our insurance and whether I can pay enough. It's like, I don't want to end up with my daughter not having to go with a gun to the hospital to get her an operation.
Well, you know, the thing is, though, how many people are actually have got that thought in the back of their mind?
I know, and that was a guy with coverage.
He
had the HMO. So the thing is, as those thoughts, because I mean, you're as good a scenario, you know, planner as any GBN person or George Romero combined, in terms of, you know, looking into the future. What as this awareness creeps into the back of people's heads, these various nightmare scenarios, how do you think it changes us? What's happening to the cultural psyche as we allow ourselves to move through these dangerous headspaces?
You know what? That is a big question. I think it really depends on what kind of person you are, how you react to these kind of things. I mean, there's a sort of Fox News watching, you know, Sarah Palin loving type that I would have less faith in, shall we say, versus, you know, the more progressive types that are sort of running things now. I think they're going to have to get more progressive. They're going to have to get more socialist in their approaches. And, but you know, like, again, universal health care, expanding Section 8. I mean, these things are absolutely going to be, you know, food stamps being expanded. These things are going to be absolutely necessary because these people are losing their jobs. Where are they going to go? They're not going anywhere. You can't put everybody out. You couldn't put 30% of the workforce out on the streets because they can no longer pay their rent.
Then what's the surest path to fun in such a culture?
You know what? I mean, a lot of it. I mean, if you're unemployed and you can actually, and the government is going to give you a stipend. I mean, there are things to look forward to in the collapse of all of this. I mean, like I say, these unemployed people are not going to go anywhere. In the 80s, going back to my experiences, like I was saying before, in London in the early 80s. There was a pretty vibrant culture that you saw, again, amongst unemployed people. You know, it was a squatter's culture, and it was a punk rock culture, but there were a lot of people who had, shall we say, casual jobs, you mm-hmm. know what I mean? And that, you know, whether they were, you know, plumbers or cutting people's hair in the garage or selling hash or something like that, they had casual jobs. They had ways of making ends meet and beyond the dole money that they were getting. So that's probably going to come back. I mean, like, what I think the thing that I foresee America looking like, maybe in 5 years, is a kind of, yeah, like Thatcher's Britain, a kind of shabby socialism that you might see in a Mike Lee movie. I think that's going to be going on for a lot of people. That's not the worst thing that could happen.
Right. It's not. The fact is, I mean, there's a lot of worse things that can happen. And if it inspires the kind of squatting that we need, which is people really just taking back the real world, you know, taking their land back from Big Agra and taking their homes back from the bank.
Right.
We could end up in possession of reality rather than kind of flattened under it.
When this is all said and done, we could end up in a much, much better place as a society. I do believe that. I think it's possible.
Well, cool.
There we go. Sorry, that came to an end sooner than I thought. But we do need to just grab hold of this thing now and own it, not look for other people to solve our problems. And by solving our own problems, I mean, like in Tin's case, he obviously is in Germany and things are a little bit iffy there. But if they work together, and if they think it through, and if they help each other who might be going through tougher times, it's going to work out really well. It might work out really well. It should work out really well. It has to work out, because look how long we've been, you know, human society, recorded human society, really, has been around. And we see empires come and empires go. And we know that they're not doing what's good for us. So we ought to do what's good for ourselves. Iffy. Yeah, I'm just laughing at Upfix here. With him, not at him. I'm laughing with Upfix. But, yeah, it's interesting. So what else am I trying to say? I'm trying to say that choose to spend time with real people. Oh, yeah, that's what I was going to say. Adam D. and Claire, they have their own camper van. And what a better way to just spend the weekends than pack up and go somewhere, visit beaches. I've seen pictures of them walking about, doing stuff, and sharing life together. And that's what we need to do with our families and with those around us, with our friends and with those around us, the people we see on the streets. And if you are, in my case, welcoming and friendly, then, and you have rapport and you mean well for the person, then it's okay to say your views. And if they don't agree, it doesn't matter. It's just they don't agree yet. And that is half of what the battle is. Convincing people that there is a better way. There is a way outside of the system. And we need to get off the escalator and walk on the pavement. And we need to get out of our cars and... Yeah, no, I don't want to go down that road because that's like the green road and I don't think that's got its... You know, but what I'm trying to say... my budgie that landed on my roof is here behind me, yucking away. I'm going to play out with David Bowie, and I love this song. It's a song from my youth, and enjoy. I really hope that that a good old Bronzy 94 is on next with his show, and if he's not, well, we'll listen to a record of him, a pre-recorded show or a archive. But in the meantime, enjoy and make sure that you do everything you can to look after yours and your family and yourself, and at the same time try to be kind to others. Enjoy, take care, and good night, goodbye, and see you next week.
Gonna be too.